Please stand by. Night school starts in just a few minutes. Night school starts at 8:30 p.m. Eastern. We'll be underway in just a few minutes. Listening to Night School. We'll be underway. The bell will ring in just a few minutes. Night School Season 6 kicks off in just a few minutes. Night School Season 6 gets underway at 8:30 p.m. Eastern. We'll be right back. Stand by for Night School coming up soon.
Ring the bell. It's time for Night School, the racing industry's national online fan education and player development program. Here's your host, Jeremy Plunk.
Hi again, everybody. Jeremy Plunk from Horse Player Now, welcoming you to Night School. It's the May 31st, 2016 edition of Night School, week number 12 of the 2016 season, and we are so glad you joined us. We're on the brink of the Belmont Stakes in the final leg of the Triple Crown, and it's a time of year where we reflect back in history a bit. As we look ahead towards the end of the Triple Crown season, tonight we look back at two of the most iconic voices in horse racing history. Track announcers have long been a big part of the racing memory and experience, as well as the learning curve, as we will learn to watch races and what to watch for as we watch the horses compete on the racetrack. Tonight we have two great announcers to profile in our biography series. It's our third biography of the 2016 season, and tonight it's a dual feature. First, we start with Trevor Denman, the longtime voice of racing in Southern California and still currently the voice at Del Mar Racetrack. And then we'll finish up in the second half of the show tonight, batting cleanup, Dave Johnson from New York. Of course, a longtime voice of the New York Racing Association, the West Coast, Meadowlands, and ABC Sports coverage of the Triple Crown. And of course, Dave's famed for that, and down the stretch they come. We'll talk about the derivation of that phrase, how it became what it was, and everything about the life and times of both Dave Johnson and Trevor Denman. Much more coming up on Night School, but right now it's time to get started. A Night School treat to welcome in one of the most renowned voices in horse racing history, Trevor Denman. Trevor, welcome to Night School.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we're here to talk about your career and the life and times in our biography series, where we try to get a little bit about everything, Trevor Denman. So let's go all the way back to the beginning. You're a native of South Africa. Growing up in South Africa, what was the connection to horse racing?
I lived in a province of the state called Natal, N-A-T-A-L, and we were, at that stage, South Africa was founded as a British colony. And, you know, they always say the first thing that the British did when they got off the ships, no matter where they were, in India or Africa, no matter where it was, first thing they did was look for a flat piece of land and set up a racetrack and start racing their horses. So we were brought up in a horse racing crazy mentality. You can picture horse racing South Africa. I was born in 52. In the 50s, 60s, and 70s would be like football in America or baseball in America. It was like the sport. We didn't have any professional sports in those days. We played soccer, cricket, and rugby, but they were all amateur. Horse racing was basically the only professional sport. So you kind of moved into it automatically. It was all around you. It was on the front page of the newspaper, not the sports section, the actual newspaper very often. So it was absolutely huge.
Any family commitment to horse racing or something
No.
you picked up?
No, kind of not. My dad was a horse player, but never any professional. Like, I didn't have a trainer, brother or father or anybody actually professionally involved in racing, no.
Well, we have equal parts to blame then. My dad was a horse player as well, so they both drug us into it, but we weren't kicking and screaming. Obviously, we enjoyed it. I read somewhere that you wanted to become a jockey at one point in time. Tell us how that went down.
Yeah. We were all big soccer players, and I have an older brother. He's 7 years older than me. And one of the guys that played on his soccer team came to our house one day, and I was like 6 years old and very, very small. And he was a horse fanatic. And he looked at me and he just said, man, this guy's got to be a jockey. He's a ready-made jockey. So we went to the racetrack. Kids weren't allowed on the tracks in those days, but you'd go down to what would be the equivalent of the quarter pole. So you're outside the track, but you could watch the races. And just kind of got bitten by it, probably the same as you, you know, just got hooked into it, and from the very next day on was just obsessed with horse racing.
But you grew a little too big to become a jockey, I take it.
Yes, we have a jockey school in South Africa. It's called an academy, and you have to go to it. You can't just become a jockey. Even if your father's a trainer, you can't just say, okay, I'm going to ride for my dad. It doesn't work that way. You have to go through this jockey school, and you go in when you're 14 years old, and you stay there till you're 19. And I was all set on doing that, but they have three doctors examine you when you get to 14. In those days, you had to weigh less than 70 pounds and take less than a size 3 shoe. That was their guidelines. I passed both of those. I think I was 66 pounds and took a size 3 shoe. But they examined your bones, and still to this day I respect them. They said, man, this kid's going to grow. And they were right. You know, I'm not tall. I'm 5'7", but for a jockey, that's pretty tall. So they probably were right in the long run. So they wouldn't take me into the academy. So I used to ride work and go to a small track. To put it in context for Americans, it would be like going to just above a bush track. I'm trying to think how you would term it here. Say a $2,000 to $5,000 claiming track. You get the drift.
Right.
And they wouldn't have enough jockeys. And you could take out what they called a day license. You could actually pay and become a jockey for the race day. And so that's what I did.
And now the riding thing didn't work out for you, but you turned to announcing at a very young age. Where did you get your start calling races?
Yeah, that's a heck of a story. You know, I always just knew, because we weren't allowed on the track as kids, I could go and sit on top of my dad's car. and I could call a 20-horse field, you know, pretty well. And people would gather around to listen because they couldn't hear the actual announcers. That was the closest thing they could get. And then the other track, one of my uncles had an apartment overlooking the racetrack. So I went up and sat on his balcony and used to call the races there. And I started probably when I was 14, when they said I wasn't going to go to that jockey's academy. And I started sending letters to the racetracks saying, you know, you guys, if you need an announcer, I'm really willing and able. I didn't realize I was like 15 years old. They probably said, who the hell is this kid? You know,
right,
you can't hire
yeah.
a 15-year-old. But bottom line, I got extremely lucky. I was 18, and they had two announcers at the time, and the one guy just up and left. Overnight, he went to Johannesburg and left them in a little bit of a pickle because they only had one announcer, and if something happened to him, they'd be stuck. But I'd been writing letters and going in to see the general manager at the racetracks, and he was in a spot, and he said, you know, that little kid's been pestering us. Why don't we just give him a shot and see what happens? So they called me up and said, come to the track, and I never called the races live, but I called them into a tape recorder. And then he did a very smart thing. It came the seventh race. He came to me and he said, you're up. You're calling the next race live. And it turned out very good because I didn't have time to panic. You know, it was just
right.
a matter of sit down. And if they'd said, next Saturday you're going to call a race, well, that week you wouldn't have slept. So I got up
yeah.
and called the race, and it went over well, and they hired me. So it was quite a story.
It's kind of like Mike Battaglia. He tells me the story of how his dad at Turfway, they had an announcer, like you said, up and left, and all of a sudden they needed somebody. He said, son, you're in, and 40 years later, you know,
well, there you go.
You're still there.
I think it's
so.
Called serendipity, isn't it? Being in the right place at the right time, just sheer luck, and you walk right into it.
That's right, and sometimes necessity is the mother of invention.
There you go.
When you need to, you're able to deliver. So you started in South Africa. What made you come to the United States?
Well, a number of factors, really. You know, South Africa at that time was obviously gripped in apartheid, which I was very unhappy with, but there's nothing you can do about it. You know, you stand up and talk out against it, and you finish up in jail. So that was one aspect. Then the other aspect was we had three tracks in the city I lived in, Durban, and it was basically going to be, I was like 20 years old, and I thought to myself, man, do I want to call these three tracks for the next 40 years of my life. There's got to be a bigger challenge in life than this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we only race 2 days a week there, Wednesday and Saturday. So I thought, no, I've got to get out of here. And, of course, horse racing is a very narrow sport when it comes to announcers because of the language.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, you could go to New Zealand, Australia, Canada, or America. Those are the only four English-speaking, and of course England and Ireland, but they wouldn't take you.
Mm-hmm.
If you need, there's no ways you were going to break in there. And Australia at the time, and New Zealand, I'm sorry, I'm just catching my breath here, was almost impossible to get in. They just didn't take foreigners in New Zealand and Australia in those days, so you wouldn't have got in there either. So it came down to Canada or America, and of course you're going to choose America over Canada. And then that's another long story, but it all just worked out very well for me, and I finished up getting a job at Santa Anita.
So from South Africa to Santa Anita, when you took over in Southern California, what was different about American racing from South Africa? I think there's some obvious points, but what did you find most challenging?
Yeah, there's a great little analogy that they always say, horse racing in South Africa and horse racing in America is like cricket and baseball. They both played with a bat and a ball, but that's where the similarity ends. You know, cricket is not baseball, and baseball is not cricket.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same for racing. For one, they race 5 days a week here, and, you know, we only race 2 days a week there. The smallest track in South Africa would be a mile and a half in circumference.
Mm-hmm.
They can have, some of them have a mile straight, at least a half a mile straight. And it's much more intense here. It's much more speed-oriented. I'll tell you a funny little story. When I first came here, and I went to Santa Anita, and I asked them if I could call a race, and a guy called Alan Bolch, you're probably familiar with him, he ran Santa Anita for a number of years. He was there, and he was in charge of basically the whole track. And so he came to me and said, yeah, well, you can call a race, and he gave me the program, and he said, but don't pick, you know, a small field. Pick a big field. Let's see what you can do. So I looked through the nine races, and, of course, the biggest field was 12.
Uh-huh.
And I said to him, there are no big fields. And he looked at me like, who's this snotty little brat? You know? And I wasn't being presumptuous or anything. It was like 12? 12, not a big field. And he said, well, what about the ninth? There's 12 in there. And I was like, 12? Because we used to have 9 races a day, and 6 of them would have 20 to 24 runners. 2 of them would have like 16. And then the small field of the day would be 10 or 12. So I was just going on those numbers. I knew nothing about American racing. Anyway, bottom line was, I said, oh, yeah, I'll do that. That's no problem. So I did the ninth race, and then the next day, he sent a guy to look for me. I was in the grandstand, and they said, do you want to call another race? I said, yes. I went back to South Africa and got a letter from Alan Bolsch like 2 weeks later saying, hey, if you want employment in the United States, call me.
You're listening to Trevor Denman on Night School Biographies. Jeremy Plunk here from Horse Player Now as we expand on the career of Trevor Denman as he's made his way from South Africa to the United States and in Southern California, where basically for what, the next 30-plus years, you would be the voice of most of Southern California racing at one point or another at nearly all the racetracks in Southern California. Trevor, go around the circuit from Santa Anita to Del Mar to even the late, great Hollywood Park, where you called to at some points in your career. The differences in the tracks there in Southern California from a race caller standpoint.
You know, I always think there's much more action in California racing. I'm going to say it's harder for an announcer because of this reason. Especially at Santa Anita, they come flying from out of nowhere, particularly on the turf. You know, those turf races 6.5 down the hill. Sometimes the first 5 at the 8th pole, all 5 of them don't hit the board. It's a right. Totally another result coming up. So they come much faster. Excuse me one second. They come at you much faster. I watch some races, let's say, from the East Coast. They seem to be laboring more. They seem to come at you slower. Mm-hmm. It might be a delusion, but that's what it looks like to me. Santa Anita in particular, and even Del Mar, really, they seem to finish a whole lot stronger.
The season at Del Mar is one that you will continue to call in 2016. You retired from Santa Anita at the end of the 2015 season. Give us a little bit of thought in what went into that thought process to retire at Santa Anita but keep calling Del Mar.
Oh, purely a personal decision. You know, it was time. I remember sitting in the booth one day at Santa Anita. It was the third race on a Thursday afternoon. It was, you know, just another one of those mundane days that you've got to get through so you can get to the weekend and get some good racing. And I was looking at the four walls and I just thought, you know, this is my life. I only have one life on this planet and I don't want to be sitting in this room waiting to go home. Mm-hmm. There's got to be more to life than that. And my wife and I have been discussing it for quite a long time. You know, I'm 63 now. I've been doing this for 44 years. I own a farm. It's time to say goodbye. You know, you've got that old thing that you've got about 30,000 days on the earth, and I've spent 20,000 of them already. So the last 10, those are mine. And so it was time. It was time to leave Santa Anita. One of the big problems was the traffic. Man, that traffic has just become diabolical, you know. Mm-hmm. I moved here in 84, and the difference in the traffic, it used to take me 20 minutes to get home. It's now taking me well over an hour. It's an hour and 20 minutes to do, 20 miles. Mm-hmm. It's really, really bad. So that is a contributing factor. But it was basically time. It's time to just sit back and enjoy my life. I kept Del Mar because it's such a great meet. You know, Del Mar's, it's almost like a vacation. And it gives me that thing where I don't have to sever my ties completely. Mm-hmm. And thirdly, Joe Harper, who runs Del Mar, you know, he gave me a great break when I first got here back in 1984. He hired me at Del Mar virtually just to give me a full-time job. And he's still the president at Del Mar, and I'm kind of one of those old-fashioned guys where I believe in loyalty, and so part of it is Joe Harper. You know, if he retired tomorrow, I might have to rethink things.
You talked about your farm. I know you have a farm in Minnesota. It's far away from what people would expect in Southern California. How did you go about acquiring land in Minnesota, and how often do you get there these days?
It's another long story. My wife is from Minnesota, and we started looking for property back in 1995 because, you know, I didn't work Hollywood Park, so I worked basically 7 months of the year. I was 7 months on, 5 months off. I'd always had the dream to get out into the country. I'm not really a society person. You know, I'd rather be reclusive than mix with people all the time. And we just got sheer lucky. I could tell you the long story, but I'll tell you the short story. We were looking for a remote farm, and we called this realtor on a Saturday morning, not realizing that realtors in Minnesota don't work on a Saturday morning. And the guy answered the phone, and we told him the scenario. We're looking for a remote farm. And he said, man, just this week, a guy has said he's leaving, he's retiring, and he's moving into town, and he has a really remote farm. And he said, what made you call me on a Saturday morning? I said, why? He said, we don't work Saturdays. He said, I left my keys in the office yesterday, and I came in to pick up the keys. And he answered the phone, and I was on the other end. So if he hadn't answered that phone, we might not have bought this farm. And it's beautiful. It's way out in the middle of nowhere. It sits on 500 acres. The nearest town is 7 miles away. And I always play a little game when I do go into town. I do the unders and overs of how many cars I'll see in a 7 mile trip. And the under and over is always four. On a real quiet day, you might see nobody. You might see one or two. On a busy day, you'll see five or six.
So, it's like, beautiful. You bet the over on Memorial Day because of traffic or something like that?
Yeah, Memorial Day, I wouldn't go out. There's too many people out there. Whenever it's a public holiday, I hide.
Trevor, we're having a hard time making this visual. I mean, you on the farm, are we talking like coveralls and straw hats here, or is this a ranch? I mean, are there crops? Are there animals? What are we looking at here?
We have Amish friends down the road. You haven't quite got to the Amish level yet, but working on it. Yeah, you know, farmers have changed, but that is a great depiction of the farmers up until about the 80s, I would say, or 90s. Now the new farmers are a little different. But I don't actually farm the land. Another farmer owns the cropland, mm-hmm. and he works that land. But I do have about 20, 30 acres at the back that is just meadows, and they bring their cows here. We have about 40 cows, young cows. They're dairy cows, but they're too young to be milked. And so I take care of them, just feed them and make sure they're okay, their water's okay, and that kind of stuff. But being on a farm, there's always something to do. I have to mow about probably 4 or 5 acres, and I always say by the time I'm finished mowing, it's time to start again. It's a lot of mowing to do. It's probably 4 or 5 hours just to mow the front lawn, as you could call it.
All that hard work, you probably look forward to getting back to work at the racetrack sometimes.
But very weird, that first day back from seeing 4 cars and a 7 mile journey to getting on the 210 freeway or the 5 freeway. Oh my goodness, that is intimidating. Really, really intimidating.
It's got to be good for the mind and the soul, though, I would think, to be able to go from the hubbub of Southern California to something so remote. For a lot of folks, they don't have that luxury of, you know, maybe a weekend trip away to a getaway area or a vacation. But for you, in a high-stress job like that you have as being a race caller for so many years and working in Southern California, have you been able to appreciate and realize, you know, just how much good that has been for your mind getting away like that?
Oh, categorically. My analogy is, you know, when you're working in a city like that, it's like driving the car with a handbrake on. And now you come out into the country and you take the handbrake off and you just start gliding. You know, it's two totally, totally different lives. And it depends what you want out of life. It depends where you set the bar. But for me, it has to be seclusion. So this is the perfect life.
Where you grew up in South Africa, was it a rural area or was it more city?
We lived in the suburb of a city of about 200,000 people, mm-hmm. But, you know, it wasn't hectic at all. And when you're little, you don't notice that, you know. I lived out in the country, not a country, it was in the suburb of it, but it was very, very lightly populated until I was about 18. I never ever lived in the actual city itself. But I think it's just something that you grow into. You know, until you hit 20, you're not really thinking of that. 20 to 40, you're trying to make your way in the world. You're still not thinking of that. After you hit 50, I think your mind starts saying, okay, what am I doing on this planet? Well, where am I going? You know, am I going to die calling races at Santa Anita? You know, nothing wrong with that, but that's not my desire.
You said you met your wife, Robin, who was from Minnesota. Tell us a little bit about that, how long you've been married. Behind every good man is a good woman, as they say. And let the fans know a little bit about your better half.
She actually worked at Canterbury Park, and mm-hmm. when that track opened here, she was a teller there. And she wanted to do something different. So she wanted to get into clocking. She was, like, going to be the first female clocker. You know, it just wasn't heard of in those days. We're talking now about the middle 80s. Mm-hmm. and actually went to California to try to get a job at Santa Anita as a clocker, and she got the job at Pomona, which is no longer functioning, but that was the fourth track on the Southern California circuit.
Right.
And, of course, so I met her out one night and said, "What are you doing?" She said, "I'm a clocker at the racetrack." And I said, "No, you're not. I know all the clockers, and you're not a clocker." I didn't realize she was brand new in town and was working at Pomona. And she said, "What are you doing?" I, you know, I said, she said, "You talk like the guy that calls the races here." And I said, "Yeah, I'm him." And she said, "No, you're not." And I had to get my driver's license out to prove it. So that's basically how we met. And she's into racing, not professionally anymore. And we're just very, very fortunate that we think on the same line. She thinks exactly like I do, that he doesn't want to be involved in the hustle and bustle.
Well, it's a good thing you've got a distinctive voice, Trevor, because no other guys can use that pickup line and say that they're Trevor Denman then in the bar.
Yeah, I was with the one guy one night. He's a trainer in California, and I won't mention him. This was before when I first came here, and I wasn't married, and he said to me, "Can you lend me your voice for the night?"
Much more with Trevor Denman when we come back on Night School. You're listening to our biography series. When we come back, we'll talk about his favorite race calls, greatest horses he's been a part of, maybe some of his influences that he likes to listen to in other microphones and racetracks around the country. Much more with Trevor Denman when we return.
Night School is brought to you by the American Quarter Horse Association, home of the fastest athletes. For more, visit AQHA.com. And by Keeneland Select, the official online wagering home of the historic Keeneland Racecourse. Sign up and get a $150 bonus and enjoy no-fee online wagering.
Looking for some excitement? Get away to Mountaineer Casino Racetrack and Resort. The gaming action sizzles, from slots to video poker to hot table game action. There's more winning excitement at Mountaineer. Stay in our newly renovated hotel rooms. Enjoy new menus in 6 restaurants. Heat up your nights with live entertainment. Play a round of golf. Enjoy the thrills of live thoroughbred racing or relax in our spa. Get in on it all at Mountaineer. Mountaineer Casino Racetrack and Resort. West Virginia Lottery, West Virginia Lottery Table Games.
Do you want unlimited access to handicapping without exorbitant prices? Then BridgeNet.com has you covered with a variety of plans for past performances, pedigree, and raw data. The BridgeNet.com Performance Plan offers unlimited PDF past performances for just $75 per month and is available at BridgeNet.com/PP. American Produce Records Online puts the pedigrees of nearly 1 million dams and more than 2 million foals at your fingertips, plus sire stats, for only $275 per year, and is available at BridgeNet.com/APR. The BridgeNet.com data plan offers unlimited access to race day data files, perfect for handicappers with their own database or to plug into other people's programs. The data plan is just $125 per month. Visit BridgeNet.com for all this information and more, and discover why BridgeNet.com is the handicapper's edge.
Night School is proudly presented each week by Woodbine Entertainment, featuring Woodbine Racetrack and Mohawk Raceway. The 2016 Thoroughbred Racing season runs April through December. And by Mountaineer Casino Racetrack and Resort, home of the Grade 2 West Virginia Derby, to be held this summer on August 6th.
Welcome back to Night School. The biography series continues with Trevor Denman, the iconic voice of Southern California racing. The native of South Africa rejoins us. And Trevor, now we want to get into some of the races and places you've called over the years. The vast majority of your career here in the United States was in Southern California, but you did have a short stint in Maryland back in the late 80s and early 90s, and you got to call one of the most incredible horse races I've ever been a part of and seen, Easy Goer and Sunday Silence in the 1989 Preakness Stakes. Because I'm from that area, I grew up about an hour north of there, I got to see you call in Maryland at that time. So I'm selfishly going to start there, even though I know all your career is, most of your career is Southern California. Go back to that 1989 Preakness and your recollections of that race.
Well, I've always said, you know, until Zenyatta came along and won that Breeders' Cup at Santa Anita, until that day, that 1989 Preakness was the greatest race I've ever seen. And you can't get a better race than that. You start with the look, Sunday, Silence, Easy Goer, two of the most magnificent-looking horses you could get. You know, Easy Goer was just so flashy, and Sunday Silence was such a magnificent specimen. Pat Valenzuela, Pat Day, two of the greatest jockeys in history. And you can stretch the imagination just a little. They went head and head from the opening of the gate, you know. What a race. And it was this way, that way, this way. So that is what I call the quintessential horse race. By far the best race I'd called until Zenyatta came along.
And those two kind of they exchange leads on the turn and then coming down the stretch neck and neck with each other. When you get a close photo finish, is it your want to make a call or is it just to lean on the side of accuracy? I know some race callers are a little more tightrope walking when it comes to calling a photo finish. What's your personal take?
You know, I go with gut feeling. If I look and you think the horse has won, call it. I don't like being insipid. I don't like when the horse wins by a head and, you know, it's too close to call or whatever. You got to have some guts, you know, you got to have a go at it. But then on the other hand, you don't want to be wrong. That can be infuriating for the fans, you know. Although 99% of them are not listening to the end of a race anyway. I always say the last eighth of a race is just for posterity. Because the only person who's going to listen to that again is the winning owner who buys the tape to watch his horse run. But whether you're in a betting shop or whether you're on the race course, the last eighth of a mile, people are not listening. They're yelling and screaming, though. Even if you're watching on the computer, you know, you're generally saying, come on, then after the race, you're like, who ran third? And you go, I don't know. We've got to go back and look at that again. Especially when it's a race, for me, like from I watch South African racing and I watch English racing, or I'm not that familiar with the horses. And they can hit the wire, and you literally say, who won? Because you're not listening that last bit, you know. So I don't think it infuriates too many people if you got it wrong. But I think you have to draw a line somewhere in the sand where have some guts, have a go. And if you're wrong, you know, you're wrong. That's it. But you, by the same token, you don't want to be wrong too often. Everybody will be wrong every now and again. But I would rather have a go and be wrong once a year, which is what about average is what you could do. Then be timid and say, ooh, I don't know, even when the horse has won pretty clearly.
What are some of the tools that make for a good race caller? You're talking about, you know, being bold to make a call at the end, but what are some of the main fundamentals if somebody wanted to become a race caller that you need to possess?
Wow, I'm probably out on a limb on this. You know, I know the three Australians in this country would probably agree with me, but the American psyche to the rest of the world psyche is a little different when it comes to that. For one, I think that if you want to be an announcer, you've got to be an expert on the subject. I don't know of any sport where the announcer is not an expert. You know, John Madden, mm-hmm. I mean, you don't question him on football. The guys who do golf, they're expert. Every sport in America. Mm-hmm. When it comes to horse racing, some of the guys have got in, and I'm not talking all, of course. The people who do know will know that I'm not including them. But a lot of them don't really have an intrinsic feeling for horse racing. Mm-hmm. So having said that, I would say to anybody wanting to get in with horse racing, and I've actually told a couple of the young guys that have asked me, they're actually working at racetracks now, the first thing you do is go to the backstretch and get a hold of a trainer or a jockey. You know, generally somebody will know somebody and they'll introduce you, and you just walk around with them for a few days, or not the whole time, for 1 hour even. Ask questions. No question is stupid. At one time, the trainer didn't know the answer to it. Everybody has to ask questions and learn about the horse. You know, learn about the horse, learn about actual racing. I just hear so much talk about horse racing from fans and, you know, people involved, that is just not true. And it's not true because they don't understand horse racing. You know, Americans have played baseball at school. They've played football at school. Mm-hmm. Maybe they've played ice hockey. You know, they know, they understand the sport. But if you have never ridden in a race or never ridden a race horse, horse racing is very hard to grasp. And some of the things that I hear, I heard a guy one day tell me that in New York, the jockeys herd down the stretch. You know, if a guy's in front, he'll lean to the left and take the horses to the left. And I'm just listening like, oh, my goodness. If any jockey did that, he would be strung up in the jockey's room. The whole jockey's room would hang him up, you know. Mm-hmm. You can't do that. You've got to ride a race like you're driving on the freeway. You know, you had your Angel Caderos and that, but I don't think he would survive in today's racing. It's much too strict now. And they just don't do that. Bottom line, without drifting away from your question, get to understand horse racing. Get to touch the horse. Get to know how they function. Get to know what their legs are like. Get to understand how the jockeys are thinking, how the trainers are thinking. That, to me, is much more important than just getting up there and being a voice.
And this is a, you know, this is a left field question, but I know that fans out there, and even myself, someone who's never called a race, how do you memorize a field in a few minutes?
You know, everybody's got their own way. It's kind of like kids at school. They all learn in different ways. Some people cram, some people write it out, some people take a long time. I'm extremely lucky that I can remember those things very quickly and then just get rid of them. And I just play little games in my head. If a horse in gold, his name is King's Ransom, you associate gold with a king. Mm-hmm. So when I see gold, I go King's Ransom. Okay, I got him. You might have lawnmowers in green. Well, grass is green. So
right.
The King's Ransom and lawnmower, those two like that. But I'm very, very lucky that I can do that instinctively. I always use the example that, you know, 2 minutes to post, we say they're approaching the gate. And if I was on the phone or something happened, you know, something that's not going to happen, but we'll just make up the story. And I walked up to the binoculars, and there was 2 minutes to go, and it was a 12-horse field. You dedicate 10 seconds to each horse. Now, 10 seconds might not sound like a lot of time, but it is when you put a stopwatch on it and just keep saying the horse's name for 10 seconds. It's quite a long time. So by the time those horses hit the gate, you got the 12 horses in your head. But I'm just very, very, very fortunate that I can do that. It's no skill or that. It's an innate quality that you just have or you don't have.
Of course, calling 20-horse fields on the back of a pickup truck when you're 14 probably helps make those 7-horse fields pretty easy in 2 minutes, huh?
You hit that one right on the button, yes. And we didn't know any different, so 20 horses was normal to us. You know, we couldn't have said, this field's too big for us, you know. So it's totally different. I remember when I first came here, there was some big field, I forget which race it was, it doesn't matter, and the guy's name doesn't matter. But he said, well, obviously I can't call all 20. You know, it was just, I was accepted. He was American, and 12 is your maximum.
Right.
And he was just like, I can't call all 20. That's impossible. So it's all a matter of perception. It's kind of like the race meet. You have a 50-day meet. On day 30, you start getting tired. When's this meet going to be over? Then you got a 120-day meet. You're on day 50. You're still fresh. You know, it's like this meet's just begun. So it's all in the mind.
Talk about some of the best horses you've called over the years. You mentioned the Sunday Silence Easy Goer race back in 1989 in the Preakness, Zenyatta's Breeders' Cup 2009-2010 in defeat at Churchill Downs. Go through some of the big races over the years and what they've meant to you.
Wow, well, you know, obviously calling in California in the heydays, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, wow, we had some magnificent races and magnificent horses. The one that I like to put up there with amongst the best was Precisionist.
Mm-hmm.
For these reasons, he was an absolutely immaculate specimen. Jeez, you won't get a better looking horse than Precisionist. And he's one of the very, very few horses I can say in the history of horse racing that could win a grade one going 6 furlongs and going a mile and a quarter. That's
right.
Virtually impossible. You know, Secretariat wouldn't have won over 6 furlongs, you know, he couldn't have caught them if we're too far back. And I'm talking grade one. I'm not talking just winning a 6 furlong race. So he stands right out there amongst them, Sunday Silence, Easy Goer, Zenyatta. And in those days, I mean, Pasayana, Bayakoa, BNBN. Man, if I could just think for a few minutes, you know, you'd come up with so many more. I haven't even mentioned the Bobby Frankel and the Charlie Whittingham horses yet. Kona Gold, you know, what
right.
Race horses. So,
and a veteran like Kona Gold, the horse you got to see for years and years and years and still doing it at an advanced age, that era has gone away a little bit.
Yes, so have those trainers. You know, Bruce Headley, I mean, he did with Kona Gold, what, 5-6 years in a row, and the horse ran his heart out every single time. Charlie Whittingham, Ron McAnally, Bobby Frankel, I mean, we're getting goosebumps just mentioning their names. You know?
What about Zenyatta? She is probably as closely tied with you as any announcer to horse, because you called basically her entire career, and you were with the Breeders' Cup in the era of her races for the most part, and she ran in Southern California. Other than a trip or two to Oaklawn here and there, you called Zenyatta start to finish. Did you know early on she was special?
The first two wins were at Hollywood Park, so I hadn't seen her. Mm-hmm. And then I wasn't calling there in those days. And then she came to Santa Anita. I remember my first impression of her was when they loaded. It was a mile, I believe, mile or mile and a 16th at Santa Anita. So they start right under the announcer's booth. And she went in the gate, and I promise you, she looked over the top of the gate. You know, she didn't look between it. And I remember thinking, who on earth is this horse? You know, and then how big she was. And
right.
Then her presence when she came back. After that race, you were hooked. You know, you knew this was a champion. I still think to this day that American racing, we missed out on a great opportunity there to sell our sport with Zenyatta, because not only was she a fantastic racehorse speed-wise, she was just such a magnificent character. No horse that I've been in racing for almost 60 years, say 57 years, I've never seen a horse with as much character as Zenyatta. I mean, you don't want to be too anthropomorphic, but she was almost human. You know, she played the
right.
crowd. She worked the crowd. You know, you'll never have a horse like that again. We should have made her an absolute queen, but somehow we managed to bury her that, she's beating nothing. She's just beating California fillies. Not that good. We missed a golden opportunity there.
You talk about her antics, like in the walking ring, in the paddock, out in the post parade with her kind of struts and things
yes.
like that, those moves
yes.
that I agree. I can't remember another horse that had that kind of personality that did play humanly to what you're talking about.
No. There's been horses that could run faster than Zenyatta
sure.
over the years. Zenyatta's up there with the best, but maybe not the very best. And we're not disputing that fact at all. But character-wise, no, nobody mm-hmm. comes close to Zenyatta.
Settle it once and for all, because we really – it's just talk now. It's barroom talk. It's two guys on a stool. Zenyatta against Rachel Alexandra. It never happened. Who won?
Oh, Zenyatta, definitely.
I figured with the West Coast you would have to go with Zenyatta in that matchup.
Well, you know, that's an interesting subject, too, in American racing that always fascinates me, is the East versus West bias. I never really got into that. I'm a horse person.
Mm-hmm.
I want to see a great horse. I don't care where they come from, Timbuktu, I don't care. But I always use the analogy that I think it's very sad and it hurts racing. You know, you think of the map of Europe, mainland Europe, and the westernmost country is Portugal, and let's, for our argument's sake here, for our sample, we'll use the most eastern part of Europe as Germany. You know, Austria sticks out a little, Greece is way over there, but
mm-hmm.
let's use Germany, it's close enough. Now, the west coast is Portugal, the east coast is Germany. Now, they are both Europeans, the Portuguese and the Germans. They are called Europeans.
Right.
That's where the similarity ends. The Portuguese
mm-hmm.
don't think they're Germans, and the Germans don't think they're Portuguese.
Right.
And that's what's happening in American racing. We both live in America, but we're two totally, totally different countries. And there's this animosity that I've never, ever understood, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Why is Rachel Alexander better than Zenyatta, or vice versa, because of where they come from? That just doesn't make any sense at all. And I still think that if American Pharoah, who's one of the greatest horses in the history of racing, one of the top, I'm going to say top six ever, had been from the East Coast, he would have got much more attention, just because there's much more attention on East Coast racing now.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't back in the 80s. And the vast majority of the big-time writers are from the East Coast. And there's this undoubted biasness, and I wish they could drop that and just say, American Pharoah, magnificent racehorse, period, you know.
I was shocked
in the Breeders' Cup. I looked at some selection. There were 17 picks, and four out of 17 picked American Pharoah to win. Now, I want to go to these guys and say, you know, do you know what you're looking at? Do you know a good racehorse when you see one?
Right.
You're looking at a champion. You'll never see a horse like this again in the next two decades. What are you thinking, tipping some other horse to beat him? I mean, do you know what you're doing? That's what you got to ask them. And I'm not mentioning any names. But if they didn't pick American Pharoah, wow, I have to question their horse sense.
With American Pharoah, you got to see him early at two. The three-year-old year, he didn't come back to run in California. He went to Oaklawn. You didn't get to quite see him on the West Coast again the way you did at two. But what you saw as a two-year-old, did you anticipate he could be the one, or did it take a few races into his three-year-old year until you were sold?
When he was at Del Mar, when I called him as a two-year-old, he was not sensational. No, he was very good racehorse. The day I was converted was the day, I forget the name, you'll know it off the top of your head, the day he won the race before the Kentucky Derby.
The Arkansas Derby, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I came home and said, the Triple Crown is over. Robin, my wife, said, you mean the Kentucky Derby? I said, no, the Triple Crown. This is a once-in-a-lifetime horse. So that was the day he actually won me over.
Go back into your mental Rolodex with some of these other horses over the years, Trevor. You talked about BNBN, one of the best turf horses to run on the West Coast during your time.
Oh, yes. And again, what a magnificent looker. Had that elastic action, those white feet. I mean, you just looked. When he came out on the track, you looked and said, this is a racehorse, you know. Mm-hmm. I remember Codajan was very good as well.
Right.
Estrapod, the Charlie Whittingham mare, she was brilliant. You know, if I had to sit and write these, I'd probably come up with 50 of them. Like we said, those halcyon days of the 80s and 90s. Wow, there were so many good horses.
What about Winning Colors, the filly who won the Santa Anita Derby? You called her, and then she went on to win the Kentucky Derby. Had a memorable matchup with Personal Ensign later in the Breeders' Cup in a race Tom Durkin called for NBC. But you called her in the Santa Anita Derby when she beat the boys and then went on to Kentucky. It was a great race call, and you said she's taking the hopes of California with her to Kentucky. Yes. And boy, did she deliver that spring.
That was another one that I've never been like – more confident of a horse winning. And people would say, but she's a filly. But, you know, I'll never forget the first time I saw her. She came out in the paddock, and I looked, and I was like, hold on, this is for fillies. That's not a filly. That's a colt. I mean, she was huge. You know, she came out there like a tank. And, of course, you check the program. Oh, no, she's a filly. One of the best-looking horses you could get as well. Again, a big, strong, you know, she would be, in human terminology, remember back in the 60s and 70s, those Russian women at the Olympics, they
right.
throw those big ball, you know. They did all that heavenly stuff, and, I mean, they were classified as women, but, wow, they were tough. I wouldn't take them on, that's for sure. And that's what Winning Colors was like. She was like a bull of a lady, you know. But what a racehorse. What a racehorse.
Listening to Trevor Denman, we could go all day with this, and we're going to go a little bit longer with the iconic voice of Southern California racing. You're listening to the Night School Biographies. Trevor Denman coming up in just a little bit. We will have Dave Johnson with this. Trevor, talk about some of your peers in the announcer's booth, maybe people you listened to when you were younger and helped maybe mold the style for you or to learn from, and maybe some folks today that you listen to on the mic and have an admiration for.
Well, I have to go to the background here. You know, I grew up in South Africa. We never had television until 1976. I was already 24 years old. Then we had television for 1 hour a day until probably I was 30 years old. So the relevance of that is we did not get any American racing, 0-0-0. I'd never heard of an American announcer before, like 1980. We would get the feature race from England every now and again, and we'd get the really big races from Australia, you know, the Melbourne Cup or something. So we were strongly influenced by the English and the Australians. Excuse me, the guy who influenced me the most was a guy called Bill Collins. He's an Australian, and he was what I would have called the best announcer. Of course, we had Peter O'Sullivan as well from England.
And what about today's guys? As you've kind of move through your career, you've seen a lot of announcers come and go. As far as the folks who are calling the races in the U.S., who are some of the people you like to listen to?
Well, I tell you what, the biggest travesty in American racing is Peter Berry. I think he calls somewhere, not to put the track down, but man, how he is not at a major track, I don't know.
Mountaineer.
Mountaineer, that's right, that's right. Wow, I would be very frustrated if I was him. I was that good and I was never got a break. The three Australians, really, the guy in Canada is very, very, very good.
Robert Geller?
Put your back to the wall. I might put him number one. Of course, it's a very tough choice. And, of course, Michael Rohner, who's now doing the Santa Anita. I mean, no, They know what they're talking about. They know horse racing, and they're just very, very good. The Americans are hard to judge because, to me, so many of them sound very, very similar. You know, of course, you've got Larry Colmus. You've got that guy I used to call in Chicago, John, I forget his
John
name.
Dooley.
John Dooley, yes. Mm-hmm. And the guy at Keeneland is very, very good.
Right, and Kurt
But
Becker.
Now you're starting to mass them all together. There's a couple of young kids coming up that are pretty good. You know, they could go a long way. Just give them 4 or 5 years to mature a little bit and knock out some of the dents in their armor. But it's very difficult to split them all. It's the same like when you listen to Australian racing in Australia. I'm not talking about our three guys. If you listen to Australian racing, I can't tell the difference. They all sound exactly the same. So it's very, very hard to have a preference for any one of them when they sound so similar.
All right, a couple offbeat questions for you because you've done a couple offbeat things away from the racetrack. You've made appearances on The Simpsons, and you were a major part of Let It Ride, the voice of the race calls in one of the most incredible comedies of all time, much less being a horse racing movie. Give us a little bit of your experiences with Homer Simpson and with Richard Dreyfuss.
Wow, I tell you, those you hit on the two best. The nicest people I've ever worked with. I've done dozens and dozens of movies and TV shows and that. And the people are nothing to look up to. You know, ego is everything. They try to make out their job to be so much more important than it is and much harder than it is. It's not a pleasant place to go down onto those TV sets and that. But The Simpsons, oh, my goodness, the nicest people you could ever meet. They made me feel like I was the star. You know, gosh, Trevor Denman's here. And they gave my hand. They signed the papers. They gave me a bunch of stuff, the nicest people, the whole production, the team and everything. I forget the lady I worked with there now, but, man, they were just magnificent. So isn't that always the way? The guys who know they're good don't have to try to act good. The guys that are not too good who try to act that, oh, I'm better than I actually am. So The Simpsons was fantastic. And how ironic. You know, I've always hated the whip use in America. I can't stand it. I don't know why we don't just come up to the rest of the world and get rid of the cruelty in racing, which is the whip. But that was my pet peeve. I did not know what voiceover I was going to do for The Simpsons. You know, they just tell you, will you do a voiceover? You say yes. You don't ask what's the subject matter. And I went in, and it was all about whipping. I was just like, oh, my goodness, I can't believe it. I said, did you guys write this for me? And they looked at me like, what? What are you talking about? It was just sheer coincidence, you know. So that was a great show, too. Simpsons, it was with, what was his name? Furious D was the horse, remember? And he had a ring in his ear, and he was working in a circus, and they kept dipping him in the water tank. And the little Simpson girl said, no, we can't have that. We've got to get this horse out of here. And they made him a racehorse, and he was too kind. He didn't want to act, you know, he would just let the other horses pass him and all that kind of thing. And then they renamed him and gave him a different attitude, and I really, really loved that show. I loved it when the jockeys walked out in the paddock and the one jockey says to the other jockey, you know, just once, I wish we could go right-handed. That was hilarious. And of course, the other one, wow, that show, Let It Ride. You know, most racing movies, let's be honest, they're really corny. They're not true to life. They're fantasy stories, you know. But that had the gambler down to a fine art, I think. He's getting arrested and he's looking at the TV to see if he's winning. And that was really amazing. There's a guy called Ed Koch. I believe he's passed now, but he was huge in movie producing. You know, in those days, wow, we had a lot of producers and a lot of movie people in horse racing. They seem to have gone away now, but they were. And he produced or directed the Let It Ride, and he knew me fairly well. And we came in to work for like 3 hours. Well, it finished up. It took us like 7 hours. And he gave me more than a double check to do it, which they don't really have to do. You know, he was a really nice guy. And the one time he said, okay, listen, I want you to call. Mel Studi was his trainer. I want you to call just as an announcement. Mel Studi, come to the jockey's room. I said, you know, you're not allowed to use real people's names. They can sue you. Mm-hmm. And he, like, jokingly got, you know, his neck went huge. He got red. And he said, Mel Studi, sue me. You just call Mel Studi to the jockey's room. Might not sound funny now, but it was at the time.
Trevor Dedman, it's been an absolute treat talking with you and our night school biographies. Coming up in our next segment, we're going to introduce the biography on Dave Johnson. Why don't you give us a little thought on Dave as someone I know that you have a lot of respect for, and we'll let you introduce Dave for the next segment.
Wow, Dave Johnson, you know, he was so good to me when I first came to this country. Now that is what you call an officer and a gentleman. Gee, what a great guy, and I think I can't speak for Dave. I think he's a little like me. We try to walk the line where you work for a living as a racetrack announcer, but you have another life. You need to live your life. You can't just be wrapped into horse racing, you know, 24 hours a day. So I think Dave and I think a bit alike there. But, man, Dave Johnson, I've always spoken as high as I can about him. Great announcer in his day. I got very lucky that he decided to leave Santa Anita and go back east. That's how I actually got my first job here. Mm-hmm. But I can't speak highly enough about Dave Johnson. Great announcer and an absolutely superb officer and a gentleman.
Trevor Dedman, thanks for joining us in Night School.
Thank you.
Night School is brought to you by TwinSpires.com, the official online wagering home of the Kentucky Derby and the popular TwinSpires players pools. And by BrizNet, the official past performance provider to Night School. Check out the exceptional and exclusive PPs endorsed by Night School at BrizNet.com.
Mike, the morning line is...
Next on FAQ 60, the morning line. The morning line odds are not a prediction of each horse's probability of winning a race. Rather, they're a prediction of how the public will bet the race. Once betting begins, the morning line odds are replaced with the actual odds. There are two ways you can use morning line odds to your advantage. First, the morning line helps a horse player determine overlay or underlay values. If a horse's current odds are over the projected morning line odds, that's an overlay, and it can be a great value bet. Second, morning line odds are significant to players making multi-race bets like the Daily Double and Pick Four. Those early morning line projections often attract the most money in the multi-race pools, which decreases your potential payout. This FAQ 60 is presented by AQHA Racing and Horse Player Now. For more, go to AQHARacing.com.
Strategize, analyze, select. Join Keeneland Select to bet on racing from around the world on your computer, tablet, or smartphone, anytime, anywhere. Featuring the best rewards in racing, free pass performances, live video, race replays, and more. Plus, Keeneland Select invests a portion of its profits back into the sport. Join Keeneland Select today and earn a $150 sign-up bonus at KeenelandSelect.com. Dedicated to the sport and dedicated to the players.
Night School is brought to you by the American Quarter Horse Association. Follow the AQHA Horse Player Now official top 10 poll each week at AQHARacing.com. And by Keeneland Select. Earn $50 directly into your account with each $5,000 wagered. And take advantage of one of the industry's most generous players reward programs.
Welcome back to Night School as our biography series welcomes Dave Johnson to the show. Dave, welcome to Night School.
Thanks. I haven't been to school in a while, Jeremy.
get out your pencil and let's get to work here on this, Dave. We want to learn about you, not just your legendary race calls and where they came from and your favorite horses of all time, but more about you and the background. I know you got your start at Fairmount Park in East St. Louis, Illinois. Was that a hometown area for you?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I called my first race at Cahokia Downs, which was in East St. Louis, Illinois. And then I did get to be the announcer way back in the mid-1960s at Fairmount Park, as you mentioned, and Cahokia Downs. And I had been going to Fairmount Park with my parents and my grandparents since I was, young enough to toddle around. And I was reading the racing form before I ever went to school, and so it's been a lifelong passion, and it's turned out to be a pretty good profession for me too.
So you're a son of horse players and fans, not people who were involved in the industry.
Exactly. We used to go to the track as a family, especially on holidays. I have some wonderful old black and white pictures of my grandfather holding the daily racing form and a magnifying glass, trying to read it was the same thing every time. Jeremy, he would spend the half hour between races looking through that magnifying glass at the DRF, and then he'd say, "How can you beat the favorite?"
It was so clear to him through that magnifying glass.
Exactly. And then he would go to the old $6 combination window because, you know, they didn't have computers in those days. You had to line up for whatever ticket you wanted. So a six combo was a $2 win place and show bet, and that was his favorite. And, you know, it was just wonderful. It was a wonderful time. I'm smiling because, you know, my grandparents and my mom and dad are not with us anymore, but they love the track and going to the track and talking about the horses and jockeys and trainers that we love to play every day.
When did it become an idea to be a profession for you? I take it you wanted to get into some sort of broadcasting and you merged the two, or how did this come about that you got into calling races?
I did want to do it, but I thought it was a fantasy because when I first went to the University of Missouri as a freshman in 1959, you had to fill out forms. And I remember that one of the questions was, if you could do anything in the world, what would it be? And I put racetrack announcer. And there's a background to that, Jeremy, because my grandparents and my mom were in vaudeville. My grandfather and grandmother were what they call blackface comedians. They would put black makeup on and do acts along with the kids. It was called the McLeod Troupe on the Orpheum Circuit. Uh-huh. So I've got some ham in my blood. and so if you're involved in the racing game and you love it, there's really only one job. It's to be a racetrack broadcaster. There weren't the, you know, the Triple Crown things when I was growing up in the 40s and 50s, because, you know, we didn't have it. There was no internet, no television to speak of. I remember listening to races on the radio. So I really loved it. It was a fantasy, and all at once it became a reality.
How did you get that first job then? How'd you get your foot in the door?
I was working for a law office as a clerk in St. Louis, Missouri in the mid-1960s. The law office had a box at Cahokia Downs. I was over there one night. It was night racing. And the announcer, Todd Creed, became ill. An announcement was made over the PA system, watch the tote board, there'll be no more calling of the races. Thank you and good night. That was after the first race. So I went to the general manager's office, who I would split bets with. She was a wonderful, brassy, wonderful gal named Ann Dutchmendy. And I said, "Miss Ann," I said, "you know, I can call the races." She said, "How could you?" I said, "Well, I can memorize the 10 points of the Yalta Agreement." I was a history major at Southern Illinois University during the day. I went to the track in the evening, and I worked at the law office 3 days a week. And so she said, "Okay." So she gets another call, and the other call was from the steward, and the steward said that the announcer's son, Mike Creed, was going to take over and call for his dad. So she said, "Thanks very much, Dave, and I'll talk to you later." I went back to the box. Todd Creed's son called the second race, and he could not decide with two spotters who was in front. Jeremy, the call went something like this, and they're off. And that's Blue Boy in front. And then you heard another voice say, "Nah, that's not Blue Boy." And then another voice says, "I think it's the five." I found out it was the engineer, the bugler, and the son. And so immediately after that race, Miss Ann came out to me in the box and she said, "You're next."
That sounds like the great punchline to a joke. An engineer, a bugler, and his son go into a bar, and then we see,
it is
absolutely,
you know, you couldn't make this up. It's a script for a B movie, but it really happened in June of 1965.
And so eventually you worked that into full-time work in the St. Louis area at those racetracks. But people really knew your career for how it blossomed in the early 1970s coming to New York. How did you get the call to New York?
Well, let me back up to St. Louis. Todd Creed, who became a friend of mine, and he then took the job at Exarban and suggested to the management of Fairmont Cahokia that I'd called the races during his illness, said, hey, take a shot with this guy. And so I got the jobs at Fairmont and Cahokia, and then in 1971, Fred Capicella announced his retirement at Hialeah, but was keeping the job at NYRA for another year, and mm-hmm. so I was I applied for the job with tape recordings, and I beat out whoever was, well, I know a few of them, I did hear the names, but the general manager, Bill Fisher, the late Bill Fisher, hired me off the tape recordings and 6 years at Fairmont Cahokia, and I went to Hialeah. That was in 71. The great Pat Lynch from NYRA, the wonderful writer, publicity man, wonderful broadcaster and human being and writer, he was sent down to listen to me, and then when Fred Capicella announced his retirement, then I was given the call to be his assistant and to take over after he retired.
So you came to New York in 1972 and
71.
71 and yeah. the 72-73 crop turned out to be a pretty good time to be in New York, as a 2-year-old named Secretariat came along in 72 and you got to see him from the start of his career.
Yeah, of course everybody knew about Secretariat. The barn area is like an echo chamber when there's a good 2-year-old back there. Yeah, we heard about him. And Riva Ridge the year before. Mm-hmm. And, wow, just think of the great horses that I got to see and call in that span of just a few years in New York in the 70s. So, yeah, I called all but one of Ruffian's races and I called 16 of Secretariat's 21 races at the tracks in various and Canada locations.
Well, Dave, we'll get plenty more chances to talk about all the great horses and races you've called over the years. We'll do that in the second segment. After you left New York, talk about the reasons for leaving New York and where you would land.
Well, New York Racing gave me an ultimatum of a pay cut and exclusivity, and at the time I was doing quite a bit of television, a lot of commercials, and I just, it was a very easy decision simply to say no. And so what I did was I ended up at Santa Anita, wonderful job for 7 years, and the Meadowlands where I called races and had various duties for 24 years. So it turned out to be a great move on my part, and it opened the door for a couple other people, namely Tom Durkin, eventually, who is still, he and I are great friends, correspond all the time, and then I went to California. I was out at Santa Anita, and I just didn't like the commute back to the East Coast all the time, so after 8 years out there, I came back to New York and the Meadowlands, basically on a full-time basis with a lot of outside jobs, and a man by the name of Trevor Denman replaced me at Santa Anita. So we had a lucky, wonderful time, I think, for horse players, because I'm one of them, listening to Tom and Trevor call races and when I was back at the Meadowlands.
You talked about your move to California, and I know from a little background research, that's kind of where your signature line developed its undertone, if you will. And Down the Stretch They Come is what you're so known for in pop culture, not only just among horse racing fans. Talk about the development of that catchphrase.
Well, Jeremy, the sound system at Santa Anita when I worked there was the same one that had been put in 35, 40 years before that. In fact, if you ever watch the old movie Marx Brothers, A Day at the Races, it was filmed at Santa Anita in 1934, 35, and you can see on the infield these large poles with those old-fashioned megaphone-type speakers, and that's what I had when I came to the Meadowlands, and it was a crazy thing that you would say something into the microphone in the announcer's booth, and you would hear it back about a second and a half later by the time it It got through. God knows they weren't going up on the satellite then, but it took that long. And so anyway, that was the sound system. I was the race caller, and in order to be heard over the crowd on a big day, like as the horses were moving up in the prep races for this Santa Anita Handicap, the big cap, you really had to underline the call. And so I put this rumble underneath and down the stretch they come, especially when there was a big horse, big white horse named Vigers, and he would wheel to the middle of the racetrack and drop his head and smoke on home, and the people loved him, and they were very loud. And so I had to really really put a rumble underneath and an underline, and down the stretch they come. And, Jeremy, then I found people saying it back to me. Mm-hmm. So that's how it happened. I noticed on the TV at night, the sportscasts would pick up my call with that, no matter where I put it, at top of the stretch, 8th pole, 16th pole, that was where they picked up the call. So I realized that I had created a monster, but as Jim McKay told me later, as long as they spell your name right in the obituary, you'll be okay.
Right. You know, the catchphrase has become a signature of the cable sports era of ESPN, the Chris Bermans, and that is like now you almost need a shtick and a catchphrase to make it in television. But what you did in broadcasting was probably 30 years before its time.
Yeah, I did copyright. I did trademark the name, and I've never taken a nickel for myself, but I have been able to raise some money for the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund and the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation fund. I mean, you know, it is a fun thing. David Letterman loved it. Mm-hmm. I mean, he continued to use it on his show and me every Derby time. So yeah, it is funny, but you can't make those things. You can't structure them and say this is going to be my signature. Just like Michael Buffer with "Let's Get Ready to Rumble," he didn't think that was going to be, you know, his signature. So yeah.
Where's the funniest place you've heard somebody say it?
I was visiting my sister in Atlanta, and she and I were in a shopping mall walking down the stairs, and as a guy passed us, he said, "And down the stairs he comes."
The grand entrance there.
I used it at a wedding one time. It was sotto voce, but as my friend Tom Werblin and his bride walked down the aisle at St. Stephen's, I was on the end, and I just said, "And down the aisle she comes."
Dave, that signature was heard not only at Santa Anita and at Meadowlands and in New York prior to that, but on ABC Sports as you became the voice of the Triple Crown. Talk about going to the national level, the difference maybe in pressure or the difference in delivery of calling a race for a national television audience like the Triple Crown.
Jeremy, the pressure was enormous, but I was very good back then. I mean, I'm an old man. I'm 75 right now. So you're talking about somebody at the top of their game a long time ago. And my mind and mouth and eyes worked so well that I had a confidence that I could do it. The pressure was enormous. The pay was great. And the people that I worked with behind the scenes, and oh my God, just think of being able to work with the wonderful Jim McKay and Charles C. Canty and Al Michaels. I mean, you know, it was heaven. So, yeah, it was a wonderful, wonderful time in my life, and it's very humbling to think of my race calls as the audio history of that time.
You called from ABC and started what, 78? You did your first ABC, so you walked into Affirmed.
How about that? Yeah, I called Affirmed, and that was my first Kentucky Derby with Steve Coffin and my friends Eddie Maple on Believe It, and Jorge Velazquez, alongside with Ali Dar. So yeah, that was a hell of a way to start my Triple Crown experiences. I had known Dwayne Lucas from doing television back in the 70s at Ruidoso Downs. So he and I had been friends. As a matter of fact, that's where I first met the Asmussens, Keith and Marilyn, the mother and father, right, and their kids running around the stable by the name of Cash and Steve. How about that?
You go back, and those ties, the smaller circuits, I think that's one thing that people get lost in horse racing. They think that you know, you come in as a fan and you may follow New York or California or Florida, and you don't realize the steps people go to get to those points. I mean, you're talking about starting your career in East St. Louis, Illinois, and then working up to being ABC Sports. And it just doesn't start at the top. And for Dwayne Lucas, like you said, you met him in New Mexico in the quarter horse days. And
yep.
That was already – for him, that was already reaching the big time from where he came from in Wisconsin. on the smaller circuit. That rise to the top, is that something that may be lost in the younger generation now of working your way up?
Yeah, I think it is. And I have a lot of – I mean, when I do a speech or a presentation or an interview or somebody comes from school, a lot of the younger people just don't understand, whether they're in whatever job they're in, that you have to pay your dues. You can't go from being – you know, an intern into being the nightly news anchor on a network. And I don't know why it's so different now, because maybe it was just that when I grew up and my father, who was a steel worker, and my grandfather, who worked in a brewery, and my other grandfather, who was in vaudeville, and, you know, I just don't think that people realize that you have to pay your dues in whatever you're going to do. You can't go to stardom overnight. Whatever you're going to make your mark in.
You're listening to Dave Johnson, legendary voice and race caller, MC, and master of all things television and radio in the horse racing game over the last four or five decades. And Dave joining us for our night school biographies. You had mentioned your grandparents being involved in vaudeville. I know that you as a New York Cityite for many years now, enjoy the Broadway scene greatly. Talk about one of your other passions there of what you see on Broadway.
Well, I love to go to the theater, but I love to be in it. I was doing you know, plays in school and when I was growing up in St. Louis, and then when I could, I would do summer stock just for the soul and the laughs and the people involved. I've actually got an off-Broadway show running right now where they use my race calls, believe it or not. It's a show called A Better Place, and it's about two apartments that are across the street from one another, and one of the families, the father, is a horse player, so there's a lot of my calls in the off-Broadway show. I did Three Men on a Horse with Jack Klugman and Tony Randall, and, you know, just those sort of wonderful experiences. Rocco Landisman, who's a great horse player and was head of the arts and education for the whole United States, the Arts Endowment, he and I were great friends at the track, went to the Meadowlands a lot. There's a real crossover, Jeremy, between people that like the horses and like the ponies.
And for you, Dave, as someone who's a socialite, likes to get out, you told me you admittedly don't like to cook. Give somebody a little dinner and a show recommendation next time they're in New York.
Well, I had some family members here that went to see Something Rotten. I think it's one of the funniest musicals I've seen in a long time. It's playing at the St. James on 44th Street for another couple months, and it's very funny. And then right down the street is Sardi's, one of the great theater restaurants. And on 46th Street, you got Joe Allen and Orso. So, and if you want a really good, solid play that'll make you think, there's a show called The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, which is a wonderful show. So, you know, if you were coming this weekend or this month or two, those would be my suggestions.
Your appetite.
You can't get a ticket. You cannot get a ticket for Hamilton, so forget it.
Our appetite has been whetted now. We're going to take a break on this night school biography segment and come back with more Dave Johnson as we talk about the great races and horses he's called over his career. We'll be right back after this.
Night School is brought to you by Woodbine Entertainment, home of the prestigious Queen's Plate. Follow the countdown to the 157th Queen's Plate on July 3rd. And by Mountain Air Casino Racetrack and Resort, conducting live racing 5 nights per week, April through November. First post, Saturday through Wednesday, is 7 p.m. Eastern. Special consideration for Night School is provided by HorsePlayerNow.com Buzz Report, where 10% of every purchase goes directly to the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation to assist former racehorses.
We'll be right back. I've never experienced anything like it. I thought to myself, this could be today. Why not today? And it was. The horse went from last to first and won by a nose. Winning the NHC changed my life. It never would have happened without TwinSpires.com. I won a TwinSpires qualifying tournament and went on to take the $1 million prize. Play at TwinSpires.com and you could be the next one to hit it big.
Join the $2 million National Handicapping Championship Tour today and plan your trip to Las Vegas. Visit nhctour.com for details.
Night School is proudly presented each week by Woodbine Entertainment, featuring Woodbine Racetrack and Mohawk Raceway. The 2016 Thoroughbred Racing season runs April through December. And by Mountaineer Casino Racetrack and Resort, home of the Grade 2 West Virginia Derby, to be held this summer on August 6th.
We are back in Night School. Biographies, as Season 6 rolls on in the National Online Fan Education Program. A treat to have Dave Johnson in school tonight. Dave, you're halfway through your final exam here. Are you having any sweat or anything like that back in school?
You're a good teacher, Jeremy, and I happen to know the material pretty well. I've been studying it for a long time.
Yeah, you're not cramming on this test, that's for sure. Dave, let's talk about some of the great horses you've seen over the years and some of your most memorable race calls. You mentioned that you called Secretariat running 16 times. Which of his races stand out in your mind?
Well, of course, the Belmont Stakes. It was just so unbelievable, and we were all so involved, those of us, you know, friends in the press box and in broadcasting. I mean, we were just so involved in big red horse that could just do about anything. And of course, when he lost the wood, there was an excuse, as Bill Knack pointed out. He had an abscess, a boil in his mouth. So, you know, we gave him a pass on that one. And then, you know, the Derby and the Preakness, where he roared up on the outside around the first turn. And then for my call of the Belmont, I had never in my life until that time called a horse in front by 25 lengths. That was my call at the 16th pull, Jeremy. Mm-hmm. Is I said that he was in front by 25, and it was a pretty accurate call because he ended up winning by 31. So that last 16th of a mile, he distanced himself, you know, from the rest of the field. That was the most incredible performance by a thoroughbred. It was like if you brought any thoroughbred and put him next to Secretariat that day in the history of the world, Secretariat beats him.
On Kentucky Derby Day, you've called some great performances and you called some close finishes. None of those were closer than in 1996 with Grindstone and Cavaneer. That was a Derby that I think your call might have ended with too close to call, because it really was. That was one of those that was a nose bob between the two. The horses were a good distance apart from each other, if my memory serves, that they weren't, like, you know, right next to each other abreast. And I would think that would make a race harder to call. What are your memories of that 96 Derby?
I remember the people involved, especially the trainers. And the jockeys. I mean, let's also remember this was really the door that opened for Bob Baffert with Cavaneer. He had been such a gentleman and a great asset to, you know, the press that week before the Belmont. And Grindstone with Jerry Bailey. I mean, you know, it's just these wonderful people that are involved in the game. Yes, you're right. They were quite a bit away from each other as they neared the wire. The Belmont track is a pretty tough one. You're about 10 stories high. At Churchill Downs, they were about mm-hmm. 10 stories. I was calling from the roof then. And, you know, as I think back of it, it's easier when the two horses are in stride and next to each other close to the wire, It's tougher when one's head's bobbing up and one head's bobbing down. That's tough. But when they're pretty far apart and one's come from the back of the pack to collar the front runner, that's really difficult. So, yes, it was too close to call. I mean, you have to give the local and the new callers like Larry Colmus and Kurt Becker and John Dooley and Dave Rodman. I mean, they call finishes that I wouldn't have attempted to call. So, they're not always right, but they sure do put it out there on the line. And the Grindstone Cavaneer photo finish was one to be remembered.
A race that you're intimately involved with was the Ruffian Foolish Pleasure Match Race, and for different reasons that race is remembered, you know, for the tragic ending of it. Take us back to that and your emotions and what you remember from that historic race, Ruffian and Foolish Pleasure.
Well, the lead up was incredible with the buttons. I like the filly. I like the colt. The T-shirts. It was a wonderful promotion by the New York Racing Association. I don't think that Frank Whiteley really wanted to run Ruffian, but he was sort of cajoled into it by what the public was doing, and then Foolish Pleasure was such a magnificent three-year-old. So anyway, it ended so terribly, and what I remember is staying up all night and doing every half hour. I did a report on WCBS radio here in New York, and I was contacted by phone every half hour by my good friend and my assistant at the time, Marshall Cassidy, who, by the way, he and I talk and email and chat all the time. He's up in Saratoga and doing very, very well. Anyway, Marshall would give me these reports of what was going on at the clinic of the veterinarian, you know, where Ruffian was being worked on, and then finally we got the word that she didn't make it. So that's what I remember, Jeremy. You know, I've watched the race so many times. I've heard I had a tape recorder running throughout and never shut it off. I hear all what I'm talking about, and then it just, you know, when they brought the ambulance out, and it's so sad. That's all.
July 6, 1975, that was one of those days that, is part of the history books of racing, for better or for worse. And Dave, when you see an incident like that, or a prairie bayou in the Belmont Stakes, or, you know, something that goes wrong in a high-profile race, does it ever make you second-guess your love of the sport?
It's part of the game, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's been part of the game forever. And, I hate that part of the game. I hate it when I see a jockey friend of mine go down. But what are you going to do? I think it's wrong for these people who are misguided, the PETA people, have just gone overboard in terms of their castigating the game and wanting to close down the sport because of something that is a natural thing that happens. And you know, you got to look at the big picture and also realize what life is all about. So it's tough, but that's a part of the game.
For every down moment in racing, there's probably 100 upbeat moments. I mean, this sport has an unbelievable ability to rejuvenate itself. It took a long time for another Triple Crown winner to come around, Dave, but American Pharoah last year, after the 37-year wait, winning the Triple Crown in 2015, could you believe that it took that long, as someone who was a part of the glorious 70s when Triple Crown seemed almost passé? Could you believe that it took that long for it to happen again?
I knew it would happen again, but it's so tough. And it got tougher, Jeremy, because of all the different roads to the Triple Crown, so many people wanting to get in, just to get into the race of the Derby, you know, always a near 20-horse field, new shooters at the Preakness, you know, new shooters coming into the Belmont, the toughness of traveling, you know, to three different tracks, three different surfaces, 5 weeks in a day. I knew it would happen, but I was kind of surprised it took that long. But I knew it would, and wow, you know, any horse that did what American Pharoah did last year deserves to wear the Triple Crown.
And on the weekends on SiriusXM on Saturday mornings, you still have your down-the-stretch weekly show most weeks with Bill Finley as your co-host and occasionally a couple different guest hosts coming in and out of the booth. But, Dave, as you covered the Triple Crown last year, how would you gauge the fan reaction to it?
It kept building, Jeremy, up to the point. In fact, even after the Triple Crown, onto the Haskell and to the Breeders' Cup, and of course the Travers, and you know all the controversy with American Pharoah up there and what happened and finger pointing, et cetera. But as you look at the Triple Crown, it really did build to. I mean, you know, I mentioned that I saw StubHub tickets for like 10 times, 20 times the face value for people trying to sell their Belmont seats. So it really did become this extravaganza. I don't think it did what the industry thought it would do in terms of rejuvenating the game because of a real lack of leadership in thoroughbred racing right now. It seems that every track and company is in for themselves, and there's no commissioner, there's no Pete Rozelle or strong person to guide the industry through some tough times, and now it's so dependent upon gaming at so many of the venues. So anyway, last year, in answer to your question, it was a big shot in the arm for the game as we moved to the Belmont and beyond. And, you know, I guess a lot of people thought it was just going to happen again this year with Nyquist.
Yeah, he came up a bit short on Preakness weekend. But a horse at the Preakness who may have stolen the show on the undercard is kind of a throwback. Ben's Cat, the 10-year-old for King Leatherberry, 83 years old, winning the big race. Ben's Cat reminds me of John Henry, not in the sense of they running the same kind of races. Of course, one's a sprinter, and John Henry could do everything, short, long, turf, dirt. He's not nearly as versatile or on that same level. But the longevity, the good-feeling nature you get watching Ben's Cat brings me back to John Henry, who was the first big horse when I was younger in the early 1980s and when I was an early teen watching horse racing. He was the first star for me, and he was around a long time, and that meant something. You saw a lot of John Henry, East Coast and West Coast.
I did at Santa Anita in Chicago for the Arlington Million. Even at the Meadowlands in the Ballantyne Scotch Classic, where I think it was at the age 11 that it was either 9 or 11, I forget. He won that race coming from way off the pace with Chris McCarron aboard. I remember I called it, and here comes the old man, and he just mowed him down one by one. Yeah, he was a wonderful, great feel-good story with a terrific cadre of people around him. Ron McAnally and Lefty Nickerson were his two trainers on each coast, Lefty here and Ron on the West Coast, and Sam and Dorothy Rubin, the owners, were just, you know, just so much fun. They were almost like a sitcom. They were so funny, such genuine, you know, people. They just exuded a class and also a love of the game. And the jockey, you know, the jockeys that rode the horse, including Chris McCarron that I just mentioned. So yeah, it was a great ride every time that John Henry would step on the track.
Who was your absolute favorite horse?
Well, you know, I just jumped into my mind because you've been talking about old-timers. When I was calling races at Fairmont Cahokia, there was a horse called Ed R., and he raced almost every Saturday night through the summer until age 13, Jeremy.
Nice.
And he knew where the finish line was, and he knew where the winner's circle was. The people loved him, and he won a lot of races that I happened to call. So, you know, of course, Secretariat, you know, incredible. The Preakness of 89 with Sunday Silence and Easy Goer, you know, how could you, you know, I mean, that just gives me chills just still thinking about that race and old Ed R.
You know, that's interesting because I go back to an old horse that ran at Charlestown, and you called this horse, actually. But when I was growing up, there was a horse running back there, a West Virginia bred named Onion Juice, and he won the West Virginia Breeders' Classic.
Absolutely. I sure remember Onion Juice. Yeah.
And he was a local legend, just like you're talking about with Ed R., and you kind of just – those horses stick with you forever that you were associated with sometimes in the early part of your lifetime or in your racing career. And so, you know, you would come to town to call races. races like the West Virginia Breeders Classic. You went to Delta Downs several times to call the Delta Downs jackpot. When you go on the road to call some of these signature races at other racetracks, what are those experiences like?
Oh, it's great because of the people, and it's wonderful to get back, to the roots of the game, and hang around for a day or two and go to the races, and I remember Onion Juice and all the fun people hanging around West Virginia and Chucktown. So you used to go there, huh?
Oh, I tell you what, I spent many a day there. I spent more days there than I did in school, I think.
And there were some really fun winners of that West Virginia Breeders Classic. I mean, didn't Russell Road win it a couple times?
He probably won five or six. Yeah, Taylor Mountain. There were a bunch of horses that just rattled off long streaks. And you get that in regional racing, where the state bred programs and somebody kind of becomes a kingpin and hangs around for several years. And if we could ever have that again in the handicap division, it's just, the game's just not built that way. But if we could have a horse who was a gelding, perhaps, that still at 6, 7, 8 was punching hard at the major handicap races, it certainly would go a long way, I think, in developing more fandom for horse racing. It wouldn't bring in outside people, but I mean people who already like horse racing and make them fans as much as they are horse players.
And, I mean, people still talk about Forgo and the mighty Forgo and John Henry, of course, and Kelso, horses that were around for 5 or 6 years in the big races. Yeah, it's... You can always hope that somebody like, California Chrome and the wonderful Art Sherman, will be around to give us a few more thrills. And with the big purses that are being talked about, maybe they will stay in competition, especially, gelding like California Chrome.
Yeah, we could look forward to something like that. Again, something to build on, and something for us guys who have been around for a while, Dave, to stick with here for a couple years. Instead of, I enjoy American Pharoah and the blitz that he had at 3, but it's just, and then it's gone, and we have to recreate ourselves in this game almost every year.
Yeah, and the fillies, we've had some luck with some really nice horses, and Tepin now, the latest I read is that she's going to Royal Ascot next month in June, and taking her show on the road to bring even more glory to American racing over there at that fantastic meet.
Let's talk for just a few minutes before we finish up here, Dave. The state of race callers today, who are some of the guys around the country you enjoy listening to? I know you're a better, because I know way back when in the early 2000s, we worked together on some shows, and you were on the road. I think you had a flip phone back then, but you were dialing on a cell phone.
I still have it.
You still have a flip phone, okay. you were doing phone betting 10 years before anybody else, betting at Vernon Downs through the teller. So I know you like a good play, and you still listen to a lot of calls. Who are some of your favorites?
I do. I play almost every day. I love being able to be at home and watch on the TV. New York Racing has a brand new show every day on it's MSG Plus and TVG, and the computer, of course, gets me to whatever track I want, even Fairmount Park on Tuesdays. But I do like, in addition to Larry Comas, who has made a sparkling career with the NBC and the Breeders' Cup and so forth. But I think Kurt Becker is just a terrific a caller. I love listening to the Keeneland races. John Dooley at the fairgrounds in Chicago, and then in Chicago at Arlington, and Dave Rodman is terrific too. I mean, there's just too many to mention. And of course, I'm still tremendous fans of Tom Durkin and Trevor Denman. Listening to their calls from the past, they were really fantastic. And of course, Trevor's still working at Del Mar, so that's a good news for all of us that like the action down there in the summer. So yeah, those are my favorites, and I love hearing them call.
Well, anytime we can get to hear you back in the booth, it would be a pleasure. But until then, Saturdays on Sirius XM. What time can people listen into your show?
Bill Finley and I do a three-hour show every Saturday morning, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern on Sirius XM 93. And we have a lot of fun talking with our gang around the country. Fortunately, Jeremy, you have also joined us on occasion, which we love you being part of our team.
Well, we thank you for joining us tonight at Night School, our biography series with Dave Johnson. Dave, enjoy the rest of the summer, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And there you have it, the live conclusion of our premiere of Night School Biographies with Trevor Denman and Dave Johnson. It was a pleasure to go down memory lane with the two of them as they talked about their careers and the future of racing announcing and the guys that they really admire in the game today. Dave wanted to add that Michael Rona, the voice now at Santa Anita, who has replaced Trevor Denman at Santa Anita, one of his absolute favorite race callers. We look forward to hearing Michael's calls in the future at Santa Anita and beyond. It was a great time reminiscing with those two folks, but we will do it all again next week in Night School when we talk about handicapping the NYRA circuit, the New York Racing Association consisting of Belmont Park, where next week it'll be Belmont Stakes Week. And also we'll talk about handicapping Saratoga and Aqueduct in the year-round NYRA handicapping preview. Thanks to everybody who helped us put this together tonight and for all of you joining us, and especially to our guests, Trevor Denman and Dave Johnson. It's a treat to call them friends, and it's a real treat to have them in Night School. We'll see you next week.
It's our eyes and your fries. It's time to get buzzed. Buzz Report brings top handicappers from around the world from our email box to yours. Our starting nine includes such renowned horse players as Caden Bradar, Brian W. Spencer, Jerry Schottenkirk, Candace Hare, Brian Natto, Terry Terrell, Jeff Nahill, DC Dino Herrera, and Jeremy Plunk. Put your starting nine together every single day with daily, monthly, and quarterly plans that reduce the price to as low as just $2 a day. We say it's our eyes and your prize, and we promise nothing but the best. Honesty and trust, no other promises. Pick up the buzz today.